Vitsa Sedionia, Nuha Brosi, Nicole Tanner, Isa, Geeky Demolion, Rini Ixen. Hello and welcome. My name is Nicole Tanner and I am the Geeky Thrones girl. I love all things Game of Thrones. Geek Girl Con 2019 took place on November 16th and 17th. If you didn't get a chance to attend the show, I'm sorry. I hope you get to go one year because Geek Girl Con is a totally awesome convention. And this year, I moderated a panel about Game of Thrones called Positive and Problematic, the Portrayal of Women in Game of Thrones. I was joined on that panel by Regina McMenemy, Isabella Oliveira, Alicia Naff, Demetria Spinrad, and Sarah Goldie, all fantastic women, and we had a great time. So if you didn't get to go to the show or hear the panel, don't worry, I've got it here for you. So we're going to start out with some introductions. My name is Nicole Tanner. I'm an entertainment journalist. I've been working in the video game and tech industry for about 15 years. I am a huge Game of Thrones fan. I've been watching since the beginning, read the books first, watching since the beginning. And I watched the series 11 times. I also have a solo podcast called Geeky Thrones Girl. And Regina.
I am Regina McMenemy. I'm an academic, a podcaster, and a writer. Our website is The Geek Embassy. And I am an adjacent fan of Game of Thrones. Like, I like Game of Thrones, but it's not my, like, big fandom. But I think the women are fascinating, so this is going to be a fun panel.
I'm Isabella Oliveira. I'm a crafter, cosplayer, podcaster, all-around geeky person. I also work for the Geek Embassy. And I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Game of Thrones anymore. Let's just say that. We'll get into it.
I'm Alicia Neff, and I am a writer, short story writer, and novelist. I started watching Game of Thrones and then I stopped watching Game of Thrones for like 4 years until there was so much to catch up on that I probably fried my brain trying to do it in one go. But I also find the women fascinating. It's not my main fandom, but I like to, it's the one show that I don't feel bad yelling at the television while I'm watching it.
Hi, I'm Demetria Spinrad. I am a writer and a podcaster. I'm one of the co-hosts of the Criminal Records podcast. So I have a lot of interest in the history of Game of Thrones and history more generally. I first read the first book in A Song of Ice and Fire when I was 13, and I'm 30 now, so I have a lot of built-up opinions about Game of Thrones to share with you today.
Hi, I'm Sarah Goldie. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I started reading Game of Thrones, I think in the early 2000s. I was in a Walden Books, that tells you how old I am, to buy the latest Robert Jordan book, and the lady at the counter was like, if you like this, you might like this other series. It's like Robert Jordan, but for grown-ups. So then I was hooked, read the books, watched the show, have met George R. R. Martin a couple times, and this summer I got to take the filming sites tour of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Awesome. Tramp around the woods in like a cloak with a fur collar all afternoon and visit all the sites.
So amazing.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about a few different aspects of being a woman. Politics. Sarah's going to start us off with this discussion.
Okay, so before I even get to the politics part, I want to talk about what's like the most problematic thing about the portrayal of women in Game of Thrones for me, and that is the lack of women of color.
Yes.
Like, what few women of color there are got killed off by the end of the show. Sorry, spoilers.
Just spoilers.
We should warn everybody.
There will be spoilers.
Everything's going to be spoiled.
I assume everybody knows how it ended by now because it was a huge deal. But yes, we will spoil everything. And I don't see any youngsters in the room, but... Oh, is there one over there?
Oh. She's not paying attention.
Okay, so... We're going to try to keep it as PG as possible, but it is Game of Thrones, so obviously we'll do our best. So, sorry to interrupt, Sarah.
Oh, go ahead. Not at all. I just wanted to make sure we made that point at some point in this panel because it's important. Mm-hmm. Talking about politics, so first I want to talk about Sansa and Yara because I really feel for those two. Because how many of us in business have seen a woman who's up for a job or up for a promotion, she's totally qualified, She's the most eligible person for the job. She's probably been doing the job already, and then a guy walks in and just takes it out right from under her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've all seen that, right? So those two, I feel for them. Does anyone else on the panel want to talk about Sansa and or Yara?
Well, this is sort of in relation, their relation to Cersei and Dany and sort of their styles of rule.
Yes.
Cersei and Dany, I think, have a very masculine style of ruling. It's all based on might and how big my army is, and I must be queen, where Sansa and Yara, at least especially with Sansa, it has always been more about protecting her people and doing what's right for her people. And she is like, obviously she has wanted to be in charge of the North, but she has never been like, I must be queen, like Cersei and Dany have.
And it's interesting to see how Sansa and Dany, we get to watch those two mature into their roles.
Mm-hmm.
From like Sansa being like, I want to be Joffrey's queen and have babies,
mm-hmm.
to I'm going to rule the North.
Yeah.
And Dany from like, I'm just going to marry my brother and that's it, to I'm going to rule the world.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting too to look at the way what Sansa and Cersei are trying to protect expands and contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Because Cersei starts with the Seven Kingdoms. And by the end of the show, she's going to get on a boat with Jaime and never look back. But Sansa starts with her husband, because she goes to King's Landing not to be queen, but to be Joffrey's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a very small, and she stops caring about her family. It's just she's focused on Joffrey, and then she discovers how horrible that is to live your life for an abusive person. And as she expands, she says, okay, now I want to take care of my family. And now I want to take care of Winterfell. And now I'm taking care of the North. But she sort of just pulls them all into her family circle. And that's how she takes care of it, as opposed to Cersei, who's like, oh, wait, no, you're not family. And you're not family. And you're not family. And I just have one person now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something that's really interesting in the series is that it starts out with all of these female characters are pretty much used to thinking of power, at least ruling, as something that men do. There are a couple of women in positions of power in sort of the less central areas, but there aren't a lot of women who are warlords or are major players, at least obviously on the stage. And as the series goes on, a lot of the men either get killed off or end up being very incompetent and getting deposed. And by the end of the series, you see a lot more women defining power as something they have rather than as something they marry into or that they get for their male children, which I think is a really interesting transition in the show.
I think it's really too bad that Margaery got killed off, because I would like to see
yes.
what she developed into
yes.
from being like
yes.
married to a king. To I think she would have been an amazing ruler.
I was so disappointed when she got killed off, because I was so invested in like what her ultimate plan was.
Yeah. What did she have going on there?
Right, like something was
happening.
Mm-hmm. That's actually, she's still alive in
the books.
Yeah, the reason she was killed off in the show is Natalie Dormer was cast as the lead in another series that unfortunately was canceled after one season. But yeah, as the show went on, it starts diverging from the books because actors had to leave because of other roles. So it results in...
And they ran out of material.
But the sept scene is basically because they had to gather all of the actors who had to leave the show into a room to kill them. That's why that happened. It's really unfortunate because a lot of those actors and those characters had really cool arcs that were going interesting places. But yeah, that's one of those weird writing things that I don't necessarily blame the writers for. They did have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Motherhood. So I didn't include this in my introduction, but I'm a mom. Regina is also a mom.
Mm-hmm.
I think, were you the only two moms on my panel?
I think so.
The show does lots of things not quite well, but I think it gets motherhood right. Because despite all of our different characters, their love for their children, or in Olenna's case, grandchildren, because she thinks her son is kind of adult, that comes through in different ways. So Catelyn, obviously, the sort of paragon, perfect mother. Like, everything she does is centered around her kids. She's got no ambition that doesn't involve her family, and this leads her to sort of regretting some of her decisions. Like, she regrets that she had left Bran and Rickon in Winterfell, and that, you know, she was never going to see them again. And then she also had that great scene with Lady Tallisa, where she was saying that, like, how when Jon Snow was sick, she promised that she was going to be a mother to him, and then when he got better, she couldn't do it. And so, you know, she says to Lady Tallisa in that scene, like, all of this horror that has befallen my family is because I couldn't love a motherless child. And, you know, her motherhood actually extends a little bit. She becomes sort of a mother to Brienne a little bit. And she makes huge mistakes on behalf of her kids. Letting Jaime go was, oh my God. Like, how would things have been different had she not done that? Mm-hmm. But an interesting thing that I noticed in the show, and she's, you know, like, definitely their sort of ideal of motherhood, is that we don't see her interact very much with Sansa or Arya. The child that she interacts with the most is Rob. And I would have loved to see more of that, but it seems like Sansa and Arya are more or less raised by their septa, as opposed to Catelyn. I mean, she's obviously thinking of them because that's why she released Jaime Lannister, was in the hope that she would get Sansa and Arya back. So that's Catelyn. So Elena, like I said, she's a grandmother to Marjorie, not technically a mother. But I love their relationship. I think that it is really one of the best sort of mother-daughter relationships because they talk about everything. Like, how many of us would talk with our grandma about sex? Like, really? But they do so openly. And even though Elena is, like, obviously molding Marjorie and putting her in a certain direction, she also, you know, trusts her. Because we don't know what Marjorie had up her sleeve, unfortunately, but there is a scene where Olenna is like, I'm not going to leave you, and Marjorie squeezes the sort of drawing of the rose into her hand, and, you know, when Olenna sees that, you know, she trusts that Marjorie knows what she's doing, and that's why she leaves King's Landing, because, you know, Marjorie is telling the truth that she is in danger. So I like that sort of, you know, how Marjorie had full trust in her at the beginning and at the end, but, you know, she has come to respect Marjorie and sort of trust that she knew what she was doing. And then Cersei. I think, you know, obviously it's really easy to think of her as an absolutely terrible person, but when you think of her relationship with her kids, it's really different. You know, as a mom myself, I cannot even imagine what it would be like to watch my child grow into a horrible monster the way that Joffrey did. I mean, how much would you have to question sort of everything that he did? And she was obviously very upset when he dies, even though she channels that into rage and revenge. And there's one scene when she's talking to Tyrion. I've watched the show 11 times, so I'm going to bring up my specific things. When she's talking to Tyrion, and she talks about when Joffrey was first born and that what it felt like to have somebody that completely belonged to her, that was just ours, and that the feeling that that had. And she's like, nobody can take that away from me, like, not even Joffrey. So obviously, sweet Marcella. Obviously, when she got shipped off to Dorne, Cersei was very upset about that. And that was the thing that she was most looking forward to after she had done her walk of shame, was Marcella is coming home. Like, this is my hope for happiness. But then Marcella comes home, not alive. But there's one of those scenes that, like, really got me with Cersei. It's the one where I think that you can find her relatable the most is the scene when she's talking to Jaime after Marcella had died, and she comes and she says, like, Marcella was good, like, she from the start, she was good, and, like, I thought that if I could make something so good and so pure, then maybe I'm not a monster, which I think is really cool. And then towards the end, you know, even with Tommen still alive, and she loved him, obviously, but I think Marcella's death was the sort of tipping point for her, and sort of leading her completely down the path. And then obviously once Tommen died, she had nothing else to lose, absolutely nothing.
And so I want to bring up Carsey, who we actually only see for a whole half of one episode. but she's very, very cool. And this has a motherhood sort of a scene that really rings true with me. And so she puts her daughters on the boat to send them off to get past the wall. And she like grabs John and she's like, "You need to be on that boat. Like, who is gonna let my daughters pass the wall if you're not there?" And then obviously there's a huge fight with the White Walkers, and she is one of the great people who are battling there. But she comes up against a bunch of undead children, and she finds herself unable to attack them. And I think that is super telling as a mom. Like, everybody, I think, thinks that it's horrible, you know, to hurt children, but once you're a mom, that gets ratcheted way up. Like, there are some times, like Regina and I are talking about, like, you watch certain things, like, it's like, nope, yep, can't do
done,
it.
Done.
Can't do it.
Off.
Done.
Yeah. Do you want to share anything?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that, too, in, I've talked about this in more general terms, but after becoming a mom, like, any kind of violence became different for me, because all of it is perpetrated against somebody's child. Like, this is someone's child. And so no matter what the violence has become, for me it became a much more heightened experience of it once I was a mom. Mm-hmm. So even the show, which I watched before and after I became a mom, I was much more tolerant of. I don't think I could go back and watch some of the first season now, especially when they kill the wolf. And kill the dogs, like I can't, like, I'm just so much more sensitive to it now. And so I can relate to that sense too of these are children, even if they're White Walker children, they're still children. And to that end too, the scenes where, oh God, you're gonna know the names, and I'm not gonna know the names. The guy who's all the babies go to the Night King, what was it? Yes. So that scene when they're taking the babies away, visceral reaction from me. Like, I can't do this right now. And I actually had to leave the room during it, so, and come back later and watch and finish watching it because my reaction was so strong. So, yeah, it's definitely different.
All right, fighting.
Right after, not like,
yeah.
Moms.
So
let's talk about the violence now.
Something I didn't say in my intro is I'm a huge nerd for fight choreography, so I actually, I chose the picture of Arya and Brienne sparring, and then I went and found some behind-the-scenes footage of them training for that, because the actors did a tremendous amount of physical training. So something that is always difficult when you are translating a story to film is that the way that battles work is not something that looks good on screen. People fighting on a phalanx or a shield wall, those are really cool formations. They do really interesting things. They have a lot of effect. But I've very rarely seen the experience of being behind a shield or being a part of a formation translate really well to screen. What people like to see on screen, they like to see two people, usually without helmets, so you can see who the characters are, engaged in mortal combat. You want that combat fast, you want it spinny, you want it dynamic. You don't want people making small movements or feints, because that's something that the casual viewer, who is not as much of a dork as I am, is not going to enjoy. So I wanted to start a discussion on this panel about the way that women fight on screen in Game of Thrones goes kind of back and forth between realism and what's sometimes called waif fu among people who are dorks about this. So an example of a really realistic fight would be Brienne and Jaime when they fight. It is a messy fight. They are going all over the place. They are wearing each other down physically, and that really shows on screen. I love that fight scene. But as we get to some other fight scenes, for instance, the Sand Snakes are ones that are really notorious for that. fighting with a whip against a guy in armor just doesn't make a lot of sense. So there's a lot more emphasis on sort of doing your special move and having your special weapon, and there are a lot of things that happen on screen that just aren't physically possible or realistic. Much smaller women overpowering men who realistically they just couldn't go against pound for pound in that way.
So I wanted to kind of start a conversation because realism is not always the goal when you're filming a fight scene. You want it to look cool. Real battles don't always look cool. But you also, sometimes when you get too far into Wei Fu, when you get too far into stuff that's just not possible, the viewer can kind of start picking up on the fact that something about this fight scene doesn't look right. It looks floaty, it looks weird. You're starting to miss kind of the physical weight of actually fighting or punching or kicking or stabbing someone. So I kind of wanted to start a conversation about what fights other people liked and whether that those fights were more on the realistic side or whether they were the ones that were more fantastical.
I absolutely love the moment you chose the picture for. That is my favorite of the whole show. I don't know how realistic it is because I don't have a background, but it looks really cool. And I love at the very end when Arya does that sort of like flip of the dagger like into her other hand, which she actually did because I saw that on the training video.
Yeah.
Totally awesome. I don't know how realistic that is either, but it looks really cool.
Something else I wanted to say, something that also comes in a fight choreography, is you also have to be showing someone's personality through their fighting style, and real fighters don't go, I think I'm going to show that I'm impulsive today. an extra level of thought that has to go into choreography that sometimes you sacrifice some of the realism at the expense of, like with Arya, you have to convey a lot about that character, and that fight is also supposed to kind of foreshadow something she does later in the fight with the Ice King, so you do have to sometimes sacrifice some of the realism just to make something that isn't terrible to look at on screen.
You mean Arya didn't show up out of nowhere and stab the Ice King?
Look, that one I can't explain.
I'm still confused by that, no matter how cool it looked. That just sticks in my mind as like, it went like way out there.
Yeah, that's something that happens a lot, especially later in the series as they stop working off the books, is their Weiss and Benioff's sense of distance starts getting really weird,
oh,
and
God,
it happens in scenes like that, and it also
happens...
How fast happens,
do the crows fly?
Yeah.
How fast do the crows fly?
Like, it happens at a macro level, like the armies march much faster than they could possibly
right.
be supplied, and only nerds like me care about that. But it does start breaking down, especially because Game of Thrones is a show that started saying, oh, we're going to be a show that does have drama about things like army resupply, and then suddenly that stops being a concern, and there's no in-universe explanation. They just had to get to the end of the show.
Yeah.
I just have Sam... on the theme of fighting, like every time Arya got her ass handed to her by the waif, I just wanted to go take an Epsom salt bath. So painful.
I just wanted to bring up something that's not like specifically about the fighting, but sort of how women are viewed as fighters. And that the wildlings are so progressive compared to everyone else. Like, they don't care. Like, Ygritte is the only woman that goes across the wall with that little band. But it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Nobody makes a deal of the fact that she's a woman and she's actually their, you know, cool marksman who takes care of everything. And I just find that really, really interesting that these people that are supposedly savages
right.
are the ones that realize that women are just as capable. Mm-hmm.
You just love when Tormund's completely baffled by why Brienne can't be a knight.
Yes.
Right.
Oh my God, that's
still
want
to cry.
Yeah.
I think that's partly due to like Yara, right, from the Iron Islands, and Greet are just, they come from such hostile environments where they literally have to fight for their lives, like, every second. Cersei doesn't have to, like, you know, fight the elements to actually survive. She's, her strengths are elsewhere, but, like, Ygritte and Yara have had to, like, fight every second.
Yeah.
To, and, like, Arya later, like, she becomes a fighter because she has to be.
Right.
But
she
because
didn't grow up
she would
way.
Not have survived very long otherwise.
Right.
Yeah, that's a something that's actually a huge conversation in science fiction and fantasy writing right now, is are you writing a woman who is the one exception for her culture, or are you writing a woman who's a product of her culture?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Game of Thrones actually it wasn't the start of these conversations, but I think it was the foundation on which some really, really interesting conversations built, because a lot of the science fiction and fantasy writers who came afterwards started looking at these fighter characters and saying, am I creating a fighter who is sort of, the one woman who manages to sneak in, or am I creating a fighter who was raised and trained by her own culture to be a fighter? And that changes the dynamics of that character quite a lot.
Cool.
All right.
How did you feel about
Clegane Bowl? Oh my god, I have so many feelings about Clegane Bowl. I've been waiting for Clegane Bowl for so long. I've been waiting for it for so long. It didn't happen in the context that most book fans thought it was going to happen in, because we thought it was going to be Cersei versus Margaery with their two champions fighting, because in the books, Sandor's going back towards King's Landing as a sparrow. In the show, things changed quite a bit. I really love both of those actors. It's always a real pleasure to watch Hafþór Bjornsson on screen, because he's quite nice to look at, and also he's a really fantastic physical actor. But it happened very fast and not in the context I thought it was going to happen in, so I had a lot of feelings, but they were complicated feelings.
How can we not go there? Alicia's going to start us off on our conversation here.
So I chose these images because it gives us, I think that Sansa and Cersei are two women in Game of Thrones who use their sexuality very differently. And I think Sansa learns a lot about sexuality because of the way Cersei manipulates hers.
Yes.
And there's the moment where she's like, okay, now I know I can't trust the queen anymore. And it comes right about the time that she gets her first period. And she's like, okay, now I'm a commodity. Mm-hmm. As soon as that happened, before I was held in, put aside until I was useful, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm a commodity because this has happened. And she knows exactly what's going to happen when she gets her first period. She's terrified of it. But by the end of the show, we get to see that Sansa has been through as much as you could be, mm-hmm. in terms of having her sexuality used against her, in terms of trying to use her sexuality or having people encourage her to do that. And she just shoves it all away at the end. There's nothing about her taking over Winterfell that is sexual in nature. She's not looking for someone to marry, to share her power with. She's just saying, no, she kind of jumps into the role of mother without having her own children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting way. And when I was looking at sexuality in the show, I found it interesting to slate the women into people who used their sexuality for something and people who had it used against them.
Right.
And there's kind of a judgment against women who use their sexuality for manipulation or for pleasure.
Or for gain,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And they, almost all of them, die.
Mm-hmm. And very violently.
Yes, very violently.
Marjorie, for for one.
Well, I was thinking of one of the prostitutes.
Roz, yes. Which is like peak of like problematic portrayals of women.
Well, any of the prostitutes who have an actual role get killed in gruesome, violent ways.
Well, we have names that we have names for. If we've named them. If they're not just naked bodies.
We made them a human, so now we have to kill them.
Now we have to kill them violently.
And I think that the two exceptions I found to this, to people who use their sexuality or have it used against them, are Brienne and Arya. Mm-hmm. Because Brienne makes a choice, I think, that is half curiosity and half love. Mm-hmm. And that's why she sleeps with Jaime. And Arya's is like 100% curiosity. I'm probably going to die tonight, and I have never had sex, and this guy likes me, so we're going to try that out. And you can see it, because the next day, Gendry's like, well, we should get married, then go have a castle.
Yeah,
and she's like, yeah, that wasn't really what I was going for. I don't know if anybody else has thoughts about... that's why Arya, I think, in this category is my favorite, is because she's just like, sex is a thing, and people make a big deal out of it, so I should do it.
I thought the reactions to that were particularly telling of our culture, because everybody was like, what? She did what? And it's like, well, come on. Like, I've rarely felt like a representation of a woman had more agency over yeah. choice, over time and place and person, you know, the whole thing. And I just absolutely adored that that was how she made it happen the way that she wanted to. And we need to see more of that in representation.
I liked a little bit, when I first watched it, I was horrified until the next day, until she came back and was like, no, I don't want to marry you. Because they sort of set it up to be a shippy thing. It was yeah. clear that Gendry was into yeah. her, yeah. and they've been friends for such a long time. And I was like, don't do it. Don't. Oh, Arya, you were so cool. So, like, it gave
so
me that
worried.
Tension. Yeah, that
yeah.
to be worried about,
that's good.
It's going to be another portrayal like this, and then to have her come back and be
yeah.
like, oh, no,
fair.
She's still Arya.
Yeah.
Well, because we were like, are they going to end up together at the end? And then the show was like, no.
Nope.
I think a lot of people just freaked out because Maisie Williams still looks like she's like 14.
Yes,
yes.
I know.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's like my age.
Yeah.
She's a little yeah. bit younger than me.
Yeah.
I heard like Google searches.
Yes,
over
yes,
that
it
night.
Did. Yes, spike for how old she was. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, something also that I think made some people kind of tense is that by this point, Weiss and Benioff had shown that they were not particularly sensitive to a lot of thorny issues like how consent works. So I think we were all kind of on the edge of our seats,
yeah.
like, how are they going to handle this one?
Yeah.
All right, we are actually running out of time, so I'm going to speed along here. So relationships with other women.
Yeah,
Gina.
All right, so we've talked a little bit about some of the women, and Nicole talked about motherhood, so I kind of avoided some of that. And I looked more at how some women had positive relationships with other women, and some women had negative relationships with other women. And so, topping my list of women who had positive influence with the women in their lives is Lady Olenna. Not just with Margaery, but also with Dany, because of course her famous quote is, I wrote the whole thing down, but I don't know how to. You know, are you a sheep? Men are sheep.
The lords of Westeros are
sheep.
Are
you a sheep?
No.
No.
You're a dragon.
Be a dragon. Of course she does. Of course she knows this.
That's one of the
yes.
best lines.
It's
of
like
the entire
one of
show.
The best. Well, she had another quote that was to a man. It was to Tywin. She says, "As an authority on myself, I must disagree." And I'm really putting that in my pocket for the next time
oh, yeah,
somebody
I'm gonna
tries
pull that out.
To tell me how I feel about something, and I'm going to use that. But yeah, so Margaery, with Dany, with almost all the women that she had relationships with, who weren't Cersei, she had a positive influence. And we don't see a lot of that. One of the things about Dany, too, is that she doesn't have a mother figure, so she doesn't grow up with a mom, so she doesn't grow up with any maternal figure. And that kind of shows, I think, again, in her and Cersei, in that masculine, wanting to lead in a masculine way. They want to take on the masculine attributes and lead that way. And it leads both of them astray. It takes them away from the things that are really important and valuable, which we see in contrast to like Sansa. When Sansa becomes a leader, she leads in a very feminine way. So she embraces her people and protection in a way that sort of masculine leadership doesn't. So for Cersei, I really want to kind of address how she has internalized misogyny, right? So she internalized the hatred of women. And so in no small way, she hates herself. And so because she hates herself, she hates the other women too. And then that ends up being affected by the patriarchy too. I teach women's studies, in case you're wondering. I'm always going to talk about these things. So her internalized misogyny makes her hate the women who are younger than her, who are she sees as potentially a threat because their beauty is valued because they're younger and because they can have kids younger, which ties back to Sansa as well in terms of, you know, becoming a woman and learning to mistrust her in those moments. So Olenna also uses the patriarchy, but she subverts it, right? So she takes all of her power away from all of the men in her family and is the one who's running the whole show. So she takes the patriarchy and she works underneath it. Cersei tries to use the patriarchy as a weapon to beat everybody with. And as Nicole and I had discussed, I love the fact that the Red Keep fell down on her head because it was the symbol of the patriarchy that she was trying so hard to get to the top of, and it crashed down around her. And I think in terms of poetic endings, that's just about as good as it can go. So not really a positive influence on any of the other women or anybody else, really. We think of Cersei. And Elena as kind of the matriarch maternal figure that was really wanting women to be more powerful in the ways that she could provide to them. So
I'm gonna jump in here quick.
Yeah.
And note that the leaders, as in Cersei, Dany, Sansa, all hate each other.
Yes.
Which sort of adds fuel to the sort of stereotype that women are always just gonna fight, we're not gonna support each other, we're just gonna bring each other down. And so that's something that was not so cool. It would have been nice to see a couple of them reach some sort of compromise, at least a little bit. And it looked like for a minute that maybe Sansa and Dany were gonna do that, but then Dany got too power hungry.
Well, it's also, I wrote this down as you were talking, each one of them lost like the most important woman in their lives too, and that was a pivotal moment in their character story and their character arc. I didn't think about that as I was kind of putting this together, but those relationships were so important to them that it made them so they were willing to take different risks because they no longer had them.
I think one of the relationships that sort of straddles that positive negative line is Dany and Missandei, who are both women who grew up without a mother, and so they are defining their own femininity, what it means to be a woman. And there's that line where, when she says Valor how do you say it?
Valor.
Yes, thank you. All men must die, but we are not men.
Yes. Yeah, I love that scene.
As a book fan, I am still salty that they cut Cersei's girlfriend out of the show. Cersei's not straight in the books.
I need to read the books now.
I'm not going to pretend they're good sex scenes because they are George R. R. Martin sex scenes, but Cersei goes on a pretty wild journey in the books that was cut out of the show.
Just wasn't in the show.
Yeah, but the incest was okay.
I guess. Priorities.
Yeah, priorities, exactly. All right. Finally, relationships with families and advisors. And Isabella is
going to
lead this one.
Okay, so my favorite example of this is Tyrion and Dany, because he is, towards the end of the show, probably, besides Missandei, he's, the only, how do I put this? Limiting factor on her,
Crazy?
Sorry. I don't want to say it that way, but, her ambition. Ambition that goes into total, power-hungry, genocide. But I think Tyrion, with Dany, is trying to undo some of that damage he saw that was done to Cersei by her father. Because Tywin definitely, he saw that play out, and it does not end well for anybody. But that he was, an encouraging person, but always was trying to hold back those
the crazy
that he saw developing in her, because everyone else is go for it. She's got a whole army behind her being kill all the people. And we just see that escalate over and over again. And Missandei, at the end, Missandei is, after she totally, Dany stops barely listening to Tyrion, Missandei is the last, vestiges of her consciousness.
Missandei was the last one that sort of kept her human.
Yes.
Yeah. Kept her humanity.
Yep. Yes, I agree.
All right.
So,
that's
it for me.
So, this is where you can find us. Quick fire, though. We're going to pick which character we think is the most positive portrayal of a woman. Use the definition as you feel it is. Mine is Ygritte, because she is strong. She is willing to die for what she believes in. She owns her sexuality. And at the same time, she is still able to fall in love and be affected by that. So that's mine.
I'm going to have to go with Lady Olenna. And if you want to fall into a YouTube hit of wonderful. Look up the edits of all of her one-liners. And just thank yourself for the gift that YouTube is, because she has so many good lines and so many good singers.
And honestly, if you miss Lady Olenna and want more, you can go back and watch the Steiner Riggs show called The Mrs. Bradley Mysteries, because she's got exactly that same wit
that same
show.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
One, we couldn't choose all the same character, so just putting it out there. But I chose Catelyn because I wanted Lady Stoneheart so bad, and I didn't get it. But as a mother, I think she was a pretty good portrayal. Mm-hmm. So, and she didn't go, you know, on a crazy killing spree, so I felt kind of weird choosing those characters as mine. So,
I want to go with Brienne just because she has. Again, defined her own femininity and what it means to be a woman, and she still is limited by the patriarchy, and she sees herself that way very much, but the more she is respected by people who are worth respecting her, she grows into herself and be like, okay, I can be a woman knight.
Yeah.
And she takes on, again, almost a mothering role with Sansa and Arya, as of like, I promised your mom, but now I'm going to take care of you.
I'm going to throw a curveball and say I still love Cersei. Not as a role model, but something that was really exciting about Game of Thrones when it came out is that there weren't a lot of women in fantasy who were allowed to mess up and stay messed up and to have messy internal lives. And what's really exciting about Cersei is that she is a villain who is driven by some really weird, gross impulses, and she's flawed on screen, and she stays flawed on screen, and she has this very intense internal drive and internal life, and she's not a cardboard cutout, and I think that's not positive in the sense of someone you want to emulate, but positive in the sense of a really interesting direction to take female characters on screen.
Mm-hmm. And my favorite is Lady Mormont. She is not putting up with any of your foolishness, but she also knows that she is 12 years old and she listens to her people and takes their advice.
Yeah.
Good. Very cool.
Good.
All right. Do we have time for questions at all? Does anybody have any questions? Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to know what you thought of the idea of poison in Game of Thrones being a woman's weapon. I think actually Tyrion says that at one point, because off the top of my head, there's four instances where women are responsible for poisoning others. There's Arya for poisoning the Freys before she stabs old Walder. There's Ilaria Sand, who is responsible for Marcella's death, and then she gets flipped when Cersei, I think Tyene's her name, when Cersei kills her daughter in front of her via the kiss with the poison. And then there's, kind of a mystery for a while, but Lady Olenna via the
necklace
that Sansa wears is responsible for Joffrey's poison.
Yeah.
I think that's a fairly common trope that you'll find in a lot of books, a lot of mystery books, this idea that poison is a woman's weapon because it doesn't require physical strength, and also because it's sneaky, and we all know women are sneaky.
I just did a podcast episode about this, actually. A lot of female serial killers have used poison because throughout history, women have had a lot of access to food and a lot of access to invalids who might die of things that happen to look a lot like poisoning. So you actually will find a lot of female killers throughout history that use poison. That trope's a lot older than Game of Thrones, but it's interesting how Game of Thrones picked that up and used it.
I find it interesting that Lady Olenna subverted that when she poisoned herself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was just like, screw you guys.
Yep. It's going to happen. I'm going to go out with a bang.
Yep.
Yeah.
What do you think of, so some of the criticisms of Arya's character was that she was a Mary Sue type. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that she earned her assassin cred, or do you think that she got it too easy?
Right. You can see me like moving towards the microphone. No, I think she totally earned it. Yeah, I mean, right. she learned from being in the Night's Watch, she learned how to fight with the Hound. I mean, come on, like what better teacher? And then going to Braavos, and you know, she was learning from Jaqen, and then she screwed up. And then she learned, had to learn blind how to use a staff to fight. I mean, I don't think you can get less Mary Sue than that. Like, so seriously. So that's how I feel about it. I think I wrote an article about it.
I think
it,
you did, yeah.
I think between that and the fact that she messes up all the time.
Yes.
She makes really poor decisions, and they get her in trouble, and they get the people she cares about in trouble. And I think that in a lot of ways, Game of Thrones avoids most of the Mary Sue tropes by allowing their women to fuck up.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's after six. You guys didn't really touch on the red woman.
Actually, I was going to bring her up in the sexuality discussion because she obviously uses her sexuality to get exactly what she wants, except for when Jon Snow decides that he's not going to do that for her. but I love the way that she gets taken down a notch, honestly. Like, it's great to have confident women, but she was so overconfident and thought she knew everything about everything. And then, you know, Stannis died, and that was like, oh my God. Like, it was the first time she thought that she was really wrong. But I really like, you know, sort of the way that she fulfilled her religious destiny, or what she thought to be her religious destiny, by showing up during the long night and helping out there. I like almost cheered when I saw her ride out of the darkness. I was like, what kind of sorcery is she gonna do? And it's gonna be awesome. And that she then, you know, she's like, I fulfilled what I needed to fulfill, and she died, and she took the necklace off, and we've had conversations about why didn't someone else pick up that necklace?
I know. I want to know where the necklace went, and who got it.
I mean, the last person who wore it burnt a child alive, so.
I'm not saying it would be a good choice, but somebody could have made that choice.
Yeah.
One thing that I find really interesting about the Red Woman is that she gives you a really good look into the mind of a fanatic.
Yes.
Because she makes these horrible choices, and instead of saying, maybe my religion was wrong, she's like, oh, obviously they were talking about Jon Snow.
Right.
It wasn't Stannis, that he was just a way to get me to the North, and now it's Jon Snow.
Yeah.
And then she was right in the end. It wasn't John, but it was Art.
She's very good at pivoting.
Yeah, which is the thing. When you believe in something that much, and something comes along to, you know, skew your track, you're like, well, I can't stop believing in that. So we're just gonna pull that in, and then that works too.
Pivot enough times, you'll get somewhere.
We'll just stand
all the way in the back there.
Hi. So I had a thought before about what you said about the two women who take on a more masculine aspect in their
leadership
to rule and gain power, both fail at it. And there's a potential, I mean, one way you could thread that is, you know, the approach of compromise is naturally going to be better. But you could also interpret that as they are taking on a role that is not theirs.
Yes.
And they are punished for trying to be, to act as a man in a world where they're not allowed to do that. So I just wanted to see if you wanted to speak to that.
Oh, sure. I think one of the points where we see that the most with Cersei is at the end when the keep is about to fall down and she realizes that she wants the baby to live, right? That's the one moment where she kind of comes back to, oh, I'm supposed to be supporting life. Like this is I'm supposed to be making something happen as opposed to taking things away. And now I can't remember who it was that was talking about that. Like, you were saying how she got smaller and smaller and smaller, and then was to one person. Well, it was one person and the baby was what she wanted to kind of keep at the end. And so I think she kind of had like that realization that she had gone so far out of who she was and so far away from like her values and what was important to her that she really lost it. We didn't see that with Daenerys, right? We didn't see any remorse or any recognition of all of the damage that she had done by kind of stepping out and stepping into that. When one of the episodes aired, a friend of mine called me and he's like, you need to talk to me about this. Like, are they saying women can't lead? Like, is that what the show is saying? And I said, no, they're saying that women can't lead when they're trying to lead outside of like their values and who they are. And that's really what they're trying to say. And it's much more complicated than can women lead. It's much more, what effective ways can women lead? Because we see that, like, I shipped Sansa on that throne so hard. I tell you, as soon as she came into her own, I was like, this girl needs to be leading these people. And then, of course, she gets passed up for a guy.
But she also didn't want it.
She didn't want it.
Yeah,
too.
That's what I was going to say. I don't think she wanted it.
That's true.
And also, but, you know, I have been, like, sort of, and this isn't about a woman, but sort of wrestling with Bran being at the end. But then I'm like, you know what? It's great sort of karma that now, with everything that has happened to them, the Starks rule the South and the North.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I will say, though, as someone who does a podcast about horrible people, in real life, a lot of female rulers have committed a lot of atrocities.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah, sometimes the history that Game of Thrones borrows from is a little sexist and biased.
Yeah.
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 Hi. Two things really stuck out to me that I would like to kind of reflect on that. The idea of a woman being labeled crazy, creepy, and just bloodthirsty as a male counterparts.
Thank you.
And also death by domestic violence.
Yes.
From an intimate partner.
Oh God, no, that's when I answer this one.
I think, what I was saying earlier, because the writer's room was almost entirely male, sometimes these topics are not addressed in the show in as nuanced and sensitive a way as they could be. And that's sort of the Doylist rather than the Watsonian. You know, it wasn't decisions the characters made, it was decisions the writers made, and the writers were flawed people who maybe didn't think that hard about some of the choices they were making.
Did that answer?
Yeah.
But
like
the death by domestic violence.
Yeah.
That trope was like, really?
Yeah. No.
Is this like, where are her guards? Where is her dragon? When she needs it. So I
feel like a lot of it was, again, like an all males writer room. It was like, what's the worst thing that can happen to a woman?
Yeah.
And like, and over and over again, like, how horrible can we make it? And to them, like, that's all they can see, really.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of it is that. I mean, it's even evident, like, in the very beginning of the show, like, some of the really horrible things that they did to women, and a lot of the sex position that they had. They're just like, what are women good for? So,
you know, that's, you have something to add.
Just to kind of expand on that,
please.
I'm curious what your thoughts are. There was a lot of criticism on this from season one all the way to the end. The idea or concept that the women in the show, their character development is typically born out of
violence,
especially rape.
Yeah, it's horrible, and it is a shortcut, and it's a, you know, it's bad storytelling.
Yeah, it's like shortcut to character development.
Yeah, it's shortcut to character development. Like, even when Sansa was raped by the guy with the dogs,
Ramsay.
Again, bad with names.
Just ask Nicole.
I know. And they made it about
Theon.
Theon,
thank you. They made it about Theon, right? Where they she's being raped and they're zooming in on his face.
Because we can't feel sympathy for the character herself. We have to feel sympathy for the guy.
You can't make it about her, even in that moment, right? Even when it's really supposed to be this thing that's supposed to be the pivotal moment for her character, and they still had to zoom in on his face and his story. And how it, like, you know.
I'm still angry about this storyline, apparently.
So, yeah, apparently. But it still drove his story. And again, it's shortcuts. It's lazy storytelling. It's, you know. And I think that was even different in the books, right? Because it wasn't supposed to be her. Like, he sent somebody else in to be married as her.
Yeah,
so that, like, there's a whole thing of, like, they just, you know, anyway. Yeah. I'll stop now.
I recommend, if you're interested in a breakdown of this, the Public Medievalist, which is an amazing site. They did a whole series on gender and sexuality, and they have some Game of Thrones essays. And one of them is about whether rape was as common in the Middle Ages as it was on Game of Thrones, and they bring up some really, really interesting stuff, and they're really great at breaking things down for a non-academic audience. So I really recommend looking up the public medievalist discussion of this, because they have a lot to say.
Did your hand up back there?
With Sansa, I think one of the things that made me angry is that Benioff and Weiss were like, we know this is what happens when it turns out to this leader, and I'm like, this is a woman who witnessed her father being beheaded
right,
5 feet away from her, and then survived King's Landing, survived all this, and you think that she needs this to be strong to be a leader? That's just,
right.
And on top of Sansa, kind of segueing in a different direction, did anyone else really think that Brienne should have been there with her as her the captain of her queen's guard,
yes,
when she was queen of the North?
Yes.
Oh, I wanted that so badly.
Yeah.
Or I mean, honestly, you know, I think Brienne could have maybe thought that Sansa had it under control. I mean, you know.
I think she did. Just that scene, as much as I loved it, the one thing I liked about the ending was hearing the Queen in the North.
Right.
But I'm like looking at her going, I want her to have some friends. I want her to have a court around her. It was like Sansa and a bunch of anonymous knights.
Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of the ending sort of cuts people off from the relationships that had been important to them in the show, sort of to rush to the end point, because George R. R. Martin had said the character ends up here, so they just sort of stuck them in that spot at the end. And it, yeah, really ignores a lot of the relationships that had been the core of the show.
Yeah. Just on a lighter note, going back to the sexuality thing, shout out to Yara for all of her lesbianics.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes,
so good.
Yes.
So good. Yes.
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 Yeah. Hi. Back to what you were saying about rushing the ending. Can y'all talk about what they did today in the last season?
Oh, God.
Can we?
I know.
We have time.
I have an unpopular opinion that this was perfect and it was coming, because she was always crazy.
Yeah.
We were just okay with who she was being crazy to.
Yes.
I mean, she locked people in a vault to die. She fed someone to her dragon, whether or not they were guilty. I mean, who knew? You know, she had burned people alive before that. I think that the signs were all there. Just, you know, once she got to Westeros, then there were people that we cared about that she was messing with. And I think that that's what people couldn't wrap their heads around.
It's important to remember that she slaughtered entire cities. That means children.
Yeah.
She was not sparing the children of the masters.
Yeah.
So y'all are saying she was Dexter and we liked her until she broke the code.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. That was so weird for book fans, because it had been a theory in book fandom for a while that Daenerys was making choices that were causing plagues, that were destabilizing the region she was claiming to have freed.
Yeah.
This whole white savior thing was kind of iffy. The show really rushed into that realization. I think if the books had been written and there had been several hundred thousand words of buildup in tight third person, some things would have made sense. But no, you can't really do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think that was my biggest issue, was that it, although the signs were there, I don't like when mental illness is also used as a character development point.
Yeah.
And I think that was really not fair, how they did rush it and how kind of they got to that point. It didn't feel authentic. Like, I still keep going back to it, and I'm like, I can get there intellectually. I can get there and I can say, can see how she went from this to this, and family history, yada, yada, yada. But the execution of the last season didn't feel authentic. It didn't get to the point where I could go with her. Even with all, like, the signs, like I pointed out to you, she started wearing red, and I'm like, oh, she's got, she's Lady Macbeth, she's got blood on her hands, like, come on. But even with that, it still was used too much as a tool for the story instead of an actual authentic process.
So in the end, she's just, like, a victim of her family history.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yep.
I think that it's interesting to think about the phrase that every time a Targaryen is born, the gods slip of coins.
Yes.
And the implication of that, that her brother would have been a better ruler.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which
I mean, I don't think they're saying one in every two Targaryen children.
Bringing about the mental illness, I don't think the show did a super great job of talking about mental illness, that is one symptom of a larger problem. Yes.
I had a quick question, because you mentioned in passing Ingrid, but you didn't talk about Ingrid's sexuality, because she is also one of the few people who was owning her pleasure.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
I'm going out there, I'm fucking John, I'm going to do the things that I'm going to do, and I'm a good fighter, and I'm going to go out, and she was murdered for it.
Yeah.
Like I said, she's my favorite. You could say some personality type things were maybe not great with her, but she just owned herself.
Yeah.
She was unapologetic for everything that she was. And I think, I think that she is the most positive portrayal, at least in my opinion, of a woman from the show. What do y'all think about you, Grace?
I loved her. And I didn't want her to die. And why did everybody that I love in this show die? Except Sansa, thank God.
Yeah. I feel like I don't like her as much as I should, because she's so associated with Jon, and I just have feelings about Jon Snow.
To be fair, though, her relationship with Jon Snow consisted almost entirely of her telling him he knew nothing.
Yes.
Which I can get behind that, too.
Yeah, she's kind of the avatar of every viewer who's like, you know nothing.
Yes.
I think we're over time.
Thank you guys.